From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. For more information, call 1-907-235-4966 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Marine biologist Tamsin Peoples has traveled from California to Corsica, studying everything from harbor seals to cuttlefish. But she is Alaska-born and raised, and in the past several years, her focus has been the emerging mariculture industry in this, the greatest state, specifically seaweed farming. I was lucky enough to sit down on the phone for an interview with Tamsin. The first thing I asked was if seaweed is an acceptable scientific term.
It definitely is, yeah. I often switch around seaweed, algae, and kelp. I mean, kelp is the big brown seaweeds, but they still qualify as a seaweed, so that's correct.
But they are all types of algae.
Correct.
Now, what makes them different than other kinds of living things that use chlorophyll?
So algae are photosynthetic, meaning that they do use the sunlight to create energy, just like the terrestrial plants or the grasses and trees that we're familiar with. But the main difference between them and terrestrial plants is that they are non-vascular, which means they don't have any venules or like little tubes that run through their organism that transport liquids. Like, we have blood that runs through our veins and our arteries. Trees and grasses have like xylem and phloem, sap that courses through them to help transport water and minerals, energy. But algae don't have that.
Well, what do they have? Are these just sort of a cell-to-cell transport?
Yeah, basically, to really make it simple, they're able to do a lot more diffusion than we can, so transport things across cell walls. And they live in, especially seaweeds living in the marine environment, they can do all sorts of diffusion across multiple cells. They're not reliant upon those kind of venule systems to transport it. They can just do it straight from the water.
And there are three different types: red seaweed, brown seaweed, and green seaweed. We tend to just use the brown seaweed. What's the reason for that?
The reason that the commercial mariculture industry has targeted those brown seaweeds so far, more than anything, is that their life cycle is pretty dang easy to manipulate and utilize in the hatchery stage. And then that they're big. They just grow bigger than the other species and the other types of seaweed.
I see. So it's not that they taste better or are better at making products, they just grow faster and are easier to grow.
Yes, some of the seaweeds, especially the red types, have incredibly complicated life cycles, alternation of generations. For example, the sushi seaweed that we eat, the pyropias, which we do have some of the pyropia species in Alaska, the native Alaskans down in Southeast harvest it and refer to it as blackweed. There's a certain part of its life cycle where that little itty bitty microscopic seaweed structure is embedded in seashells. So the big brown seaweeds are much easier to manipulate and utilize their natural life histories and life cycles for commercial purposes. And that's not to say that the browns are any better or worse than some of these other red ones. The red seaweeds tend to have much more higher market value. Again, those sushi seaweeds, the glossularias, they have a lot more market potential for extractions and pharmaceuticals, but they're just much more difficult to grow.
Well, you have operated kelp hatcheries.
Correct.
That is amazing to me that they're hatcheries rather than nurseries. Why do you call them hatcheries, and are hatcheries necessary for kelp production?
So the reason we call them hatcheries versus nurseries, nursery is probably a much more analogous term just based off of the fact that we're growing sort of plants. The reason we refer to them as hatcheries is because of the nomenclature and wording that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game uses for the permitting process, because we're going from the egg stage of this animal, not just rearing it from a juvenile stage. So we're actually going back, starting with a parent plant and getting it to reproduce completely. So we're not just growing small plants and the bigger plants like a nursery system does, but we're actually creating and hatching eggs.
And I understand at the first, the kelp, what would be the correct word for that? They swim around.
The spores, yeah. It's pretty incredible to think that these big, giant kelps, like even your huge bull kelps that can grow in over 100 feet of seawater, so they're over 100 feet long, produce these single-celled swimming spores that are just in the water. The life cycle of these big brown seaweeds, these kelps, is much more similar to a mushroom, a fungus, or even a fern, where they have these motile swimming spores that swim around in the water. And they're kind of at the whim of the ocean in terms of where those spores end up. They can swim, but they're tiny. They can't swim very far or very fast, but they are dependent and at the whim of the currents in the ocean around them to transport them. Eventually, they stop, settle, and adhere to a surface, whether that's a rock in the intertidal zone, the bottom of your boat, potentially even to like an animal or an organism. But they don't really have much control over where they do settle onto. And then they germinate into these little male and female gametophytes. And these are only a few cells long, so they're still microscopic. Those gametophytes then mature and then fertilize one another. The females produce a little egg. The male gametophytes produce sperm, which is crazy to think of, that these tiny microscopic gametophytes are just producing sperm. They're only, you know, a few cells long. They produce sperm. Those sperms somehow have to then swim through the water and find that egg of the same species of kelp and fertilize it. So the amount of kind of chance that these organisms have to depend upon in order to reproduce is pretty phenomenal and mind-blowing to think about. And then that fertilized little egg becomes a little tiny kelp plant that grows and grows and grows until it gets to its, you know, big 100-foot-tall bull kelp plant.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard-accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
An expanding industry assumes an expanding market. Are we sure that that market exists?
Yes, definitely. But we've seen these two pioneering companies in Alaska, Blue Evolution out of the Kodiak area and Seagrove Kelp down in the Prince Wales Island area, that side of Craig. They've done really well for themselves with their product. They're all focusing on food at this point. It's a good bang for your buck for the species that we're growing. But a market analysis just came out from the McKinley Research Group in cooperation with Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation that shows that, yeah, there's definitely a market, both domestically and potentially even internationally.
You need to process your kelp within a certain window during the year. Why is that?
Kelp grows really fast. You know, these are annual plants. Believe it or not, that 100-foot-tall bull kelp is going to be gone in the winter. A little baby plant's going to recruit in the spring or start to grow in the spring and then grow all summer and spring. And then by the fall, as those big winter storms come in, just get ripped up and die. So these kelps are really growing from nothing to their maximum size in about 6 months. So it's a very seasonal market. We outplant the commercial operations in the fall, usually around October, November, early December. And you want to harvest them in the spring. They do reach a maximum growth, so they grow exponentially until a certain point where we think they start competing for resources in the water with phytoplankton or other marine organisms that are filtering out those same minerals and nutrients. If you've spent a lot of time on the water, usually around mid-April, the water clarity will go from, you know, 20, 30 foot visibility down to 5 or 10 feet as the water turns to pea soup. And that's that big phytoplankton bloom that always happens in the spring when the water show gets right and the daylight gets right, those phytoplankton just explode, and then they start to compete for those same resources that the bull kelp or the commercial crop is. So we've seen that the seaweeds just stop kind of growing exponentially. They'll stabilize their growth and then eventually start to degrade. And these big seaweeds, like the big sugar kelp, which are one big blade or one big leaf, they grow kind of like our hair does. They grow from the bottom up, so their ends, their tips just get raggedy and split, just like our hair does. And usually the seaweed can grow fast enough to replace those dead raggedy ends that break off, but eventually that growth rate kind of plateaus, and other little critters and marine organisms like bryozoans, barnacles, snails, I've seen mussels grow on seaweed. Those things will come in too and adhere to the seaweed. And if you're doing a food product, you don't really want all that junk growing on your kelp. Call it biofouling.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, providing twice weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.
Businesses who are already large, like big fish processing companies, are they going to have a huge advantage in once they start to go forward in the industry compared to fishermen trying to build small individual businesses?
Yeah, that's a definite concern. I think a lot of people are kind of worried about seeing the loss of the small commercial farmer and giving those or seeing those big corporations come in and kind of monopolizing the resource. So far, that has not happened. Again, we've seen these big processors, multiple big processors, apply for sites across the state from southeast all the way out into southwest Alaska. But no one's really gone forward beyond that. So far, it is all the small independent farmers that are coming together to really push this industry forward. My hope is that we see something very similar to what we see with the commercial fisheries happen with seafood, so that we have these independent fishermen who can sell their product to a processor or to a buyer, but maintaining their independence and their own site and their own crop.
But just looking at it from the processor's point of view, is there an incentive to them to help the independent harvester when they can just do it all by themselves?
One thing that I think will help prevent that from happening, of seeing these giant corporations coming in and out-competing the local fisherman or the local kelp farmer, is just having open communication between farmers, potentially forming co-ops. There's been a lot of motion in the Prince William Sound area of forming a co-op of kelp farmers together that would run their own hatchery nursery, their own kelp processing, and doing their own product development. That might be a really good option to create the industry and create the sustainable, responsible seaweed industry in a certain area while maintaining those independent local farmers.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund in recognition of the fishing industry, which provides over 58,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.